It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to Democratic State Assembly Representative Katrina Shankland about water contamination issues in the state. First, there's a lot of variety in the world of Indian food. And for people who didn't grow up with it, it can be hard to know where to start if you want to make it at home. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has a lot of ideas, and she says it doesn't have to be a faithful recreation of a recipe from India. It can be Indian-ish. Priya Krishna writes about food and has contributed to the New York Times, Bon Appetit, and The New Yorker. She wrote a college-focused cookbook about dining hall hacks. She's got a new cookbook out that draws from her mother's cooking with Indian influences. The book is Indian-ish, Recipes and Antics from a Modern American Family. Priya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us this concept of Indian-ish that you got for your mom and the rest of your family.
Yeah, well, you know, my mom, she only learned to cook once she immigrated to the U.S. from India. So she had these memories of foods that she ate as a child, aloo gobi, dal chawal, but she didn't have all the ingredients she was looking for. So what was sort of born out of those limitations were these beautiful hybridized dishes like sag paneer, but with feta instead of paneer, and pizza made with roti. You know, we grew up sort of just eating food that was rooted in Indian flavors, but definitely pulled from influences from, you know, the PBS cooking shows my mom was watching, the countries she was traveling to, and just what was available in American grocery stores.
And you write that Indian food or Indian-ish food is everyday food. And for people who maybe been to a lot of Indian restaurants in the United States and encountered, as I have, you know, really heavy stuff that is definitely what Sesame Street would call sometimes food, that might be kind of a surprise.
Yeah, I think there are all these misconceptions. Indian food is complicated. It's heavy. It's rich. The food I grew up with is nothing like that. First of all, it's quick and straightforward. It takes 20 to 25 minutes to make start to finish. These are not project recipes. And second, you know, it's light, bright, healthy-ish fare. You know, Indian food, like any cuisine, has heavier indulgences and, you know, brighter food. But the food I grew up with was really healthy. It was kind of nothing like what you would find in restaurants.
Now, I think in the United States, for a lot of us, when we hear Indian food, we think of a dish with curry in the name. And you write, well, sorry, there's not really such a thing as curry. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, I just despise the word curry. It was basically this word that was popularized by European colonizers in India and kind of exported throughout the West and used to kind of just reduce Indian food to a single word. When I think of curry, I think of this sort of monochromatic stew. And, you know, that word sort of ignores the nuance inherent in Indian food. And I hate that instead of calling the foods by their actual, the names of the dishes, people just call everything a curry. So I explicitly wanted to ban that word from the book.
Talking to Priya Krishna about her new book, Indian-ish, a cookbook, a lot of foods inspired by Indian cuisine. Priya, one technique that I've done, and I didn't know it had a name, chonk. Am I saying that right?
Chonk, yeah.
What is that? Explain it to us.
Sure. It is spices and or herbs that have been tempered in oil or ghee. And it's sort of this topper for, you know, dal, any kind of rice, a vegetable dish. And it adds this like shot of richness. And what happens is when you temper spices in oil, the oil gets infused with the spices. The spices get this amazing texture. It brings out the flavor and the aromatics of the spices. It sort of adds this layer of complexity to any dish and this really amazing crunch. You know, it's sort of like finishing something, like drizzling a finished pasta with a pat with olive oil or melting in a pat of butter. It's like that, but more flavorful.
And Exhibit A is doing this with cumin seed.
Yes. Yeah. That's probably my all-time favorite chonk. You heat up some ghee, add cumin seeds, take it off the heat, add dried chilies, red chili powder, and asafoetida or hing, which is this sort of garlicky-like tree resin that is used in Indian cuisine. And it just, you can put it over anything from dal to noodles to nachos. Chonk nachos are the greatest thing.
That sounds good. Now, you mentioned ghee there. Talk about ghee, how important it is, and if we can fake it if we don't have it.
Honestly, ghee is super fundamental to Indian food. I think it just makes everything taste so good. It kind of is like butter, but amplified. It's like butterscotchy butter, basically. And really all you do is just melt a stick of butter in a pan. And once you see the milk solids floating on top, just skim those off and you're left with ghee. You know, if you don't feel like making ghee, you can totally just use butter or you can use oil as we do in the book. I think one thing that I really wanted to do with this book is, you know, present substitutions wherever I could, because my mom's entire cooking regimen was based off of having to make substitutions.
Now let's get to some of the recipes. You've shared a few of them with us. We've got them online at WPR.org/foodfriday. Roti pizza. You mentioned making pizzas. Now, roti is that round bread, right? And how do we make a good Indian-ish roti pizza?
Roti pizza. Roti is also known as chapati. It's basically just like a wheat flatbread. And I mean, you just pre-bake the rotis, then you add your toppings. Our favorite ones to add, which is very Indian-ish, is sliced red onions, cheddar cheese, and cilantro chutney. And then you bake it, and just it's amazing the way the crust kind of crisps and curls and chars just like a pizza crust. And it's sort of like having your own little personal pizza, and you can make a bunch of them and top them with all sorts of things, from tomatoes and mozzarella to, we love thinly sliced potatoes and Parmesan cheese and rosemary. And you can just, we love just putting a bunch out and having a party.
And you mentioned substitutions. You suggest one here. You know, some places in Wisconsin, rotis you could find in grocery stores. Some places you probably can't. You say whole wheat tortillas can do in a pinch.
They work great. In fact, my mom in Texas, we have a local grocer called Central Market. And my mom loves their whole wheat tortillas and uses them instead of roti. I mean, basically the ingredients are the same in those ones, and they're so good.
And I imagine once you do the basics, you suggest a couple toppings, but you could mix and match different Indian-themed veggies, meats, sauces, whatever, on your roti pizza.
They don't even have to be Indian-themed. We've done tomatoes, mozzarella, and basil. We've done Kalamata olives, capers, and onions. I think, you know, there's no limit to what you can put on a roti pizza.
We're talking to Priya Krishna. She's a food writer, and her new book is called Indian-ish Recipes and Antics from a Modern American Family. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how to cook Indian-influenced food in your own kitchen? Do you have some local tips on where to buy specific spices or ingredients? Is this part of your family heritage? Do you have Indian-ish dishes that your family has put together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Priya Krishna. Her new cookbook is Indian-ish, Recipes and Antics from a Modern American Family. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried or been thinking about trying to cook Indian food or Indian-influenced food yourself? What kind of successes, what kind of failures have you had along the way? Is this food you grew up with and you'd want to share a favorite? Or just have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Priya, load up our spice arsenal for us, if you would. What kind of handful of key spices do we want to have around to make Indian-ish food?
Well, I think one thing to point out is that not all Indian food has spices. You know, you don't need a cabinet full of spices to make a lot of Indian dishes. But my favorite, all-time favorite, is cumin seeds. I think cumin seeds are so universal. You can use them in so many different ways. Some people are used to ground cumin, but the seeds are amazing. Mustard seeds and curry leaves are sort of this duet of flavors. It's really earthy and herbaceous. I love putting that on anything. And then same with coriander seeds. Those are just flavor bombs. And I love putting them in sag feta and cardamom pods. I think the key here is finding the spices in their whole form, because that's when they're going to be the most flavorful. They're going to, you know, smell the most amazing coming out of the dish.
Now, in a past Food Friday, I talked to a guest. I think his book was called Flavor Walla, and he got me doing what is chonk. I didn't know it was called that. And also taking those cumin seeds or coriander seeds or whatever and grinding them up fresh right before I cook with them. Is that something you do too?
No, I mean, I think it's a common misconception that every single Indian cook is making like spice blends with six spices and putting them into the dish. Indian food is can be a lot more straightforward than that. Oftentimes, my mom is just tossing the whole spices directly into the pan, and they taste great. I sometimes feel like there's this misconception that every dish involves six spices, and you're grinding those spices, and it's not that complicated.
Yeah, I feel like I could live with like just cumin and salt and pepper sometimes. My family sometimes enough with the cumin, Rob, but I could go with it.
As could I. You'll notice in a lot of my recipes, cumin plays a main role.
Well, let's check out another recipe you've shared with us, matar paneer. Now, we should love paneer in Wisconsin. It's a kind of cheese, right?
Mm-hmm. It's pronounced mutter paneer.
Mutter paneer. Thank you.
Yeah.
And tell us about that recipe.
Yeah. I mean, that is kind of as classic as it gets. There's really very little that's Indian, that's ish about it. That's just straight up, you know, North Indian. It's just this wonderful, like, aromatic cardamom and coriander based tomato gravy. And you mix in, you know, peas and chunks of paneer, and the paneer is mild, but it does such an amazing job of soaking up all the flavors of that tomato gravy, and served over rice, it is just like the ultimate entertaining food. No one dislikes mutter paneer.
And you mentioned earlier the idea of substituting in feta cheese for that paneer, and that's going to add a different kind of flavor for sure.
That's actually I would not suggest
for this
substituting
recipe.
In feta for this recipe. That's for a recipe called feta cooked like sag paneer, or sag feta.
And sag is a spinach thing, right?
Yeah. So sag, where I'm from in India, it sort of refers to greens generally. In some places, it refers to mustard greens, but we basically just make a gravy with spinach. And instead of folding in paneer, we fold in feta, because that spinach and feta combination is just so deadly.
All right. I want to get to our desserts now. You shared a cardamom bread pudding, shahi toast. Tell us about how this one comes together.
It could not be easier. You are just heating up heavy cream and mixing in sugar and crushed fresh cardamom out of the pods. That's really what makes this dish. Then you're toasting little pieces of white bread, soaking that in the cream, and then you just let it sit in the fridge overnight. I think this dish has maybe four or five ingredients, but it tastes super luxurious, and you kind of scoop the shahi toast out like it with an ice cream scoop, and just these drippy pieces of bread with that infused cardamom cream, and it's just so delicious. That with a cup of chai is the best dessert.
We're talking to Priya Krishna. Her new cookbook is called Indian-ish Recipes and Antics from a Modern American Family. Now, you list your mom as a co-author here, Ritu Krishna. What was it like working with your mom on this project?
Yeah, it's Ritu Krishna. She was amazing. My mom is a software programmer by training. She, now manages a team of programmers, and she just project managed the heck out of this cookbook. She wrote all 100 recipes. She was sort of the calming presence during the photo shoot. She, you know, was right there alongside me reading the book for errors, making sure the recipes were airtight. You know, obviously she's my mom, so we bickered quite a bit. But she was an amazing partner. I couldn't have asked her anyone better.
And most of the pictures I think I read somewhere are in her cookware or her servingware.
Yeah, my mom, we've been lucky because my mom was a software programmer for the airline industry. We were able to travel all around the world. And my mom loves picking up like little, you know, bits and pottery and vases from each place we go to. So we shot most of the dishes and pottery from around the world.
Now, it's of course spring heading into summer. Is there a favorite seasonal ingredient going on right now that you like to mix into your cooking? Maybe something that made its way into your book.
Yeah, I mean, we're like on the cusp of tomato season, which makes me so happy. And one of my favorite recipes in the book is a quick pickle you make with green chilies and, you know, really awesome, top of season cherry tomatoes. And basically what you're doing is just combining a bunch of spices in a pot with green chilies, and then right at the end you hit it with the cherry tomatoes, and then but you don't cook it, you just kind of dump it into a bowl, and it takes 5 minutes to put together, and the cherry tomatoes don't cook, so they're like sort of a, this really fresh component contrasted against the cooked chilies and the intensity of the spices, and you have those like peak season summery sweet like candy tomatoes. It just is perfect.
And one more ingredient, it's a little further out in the season for us, but you write that you're a fan of okra, and I am too, but I'm not always sure what to do with it. What are some of your favorite ways as an okra fan do you use it?
The recipe in my book is the only way I cook okra, because I think it is the best way. Basically, what you're doing is you're just cooking it on almost like you would do like an asparagus on really, really high heat with a little bit of oil until it sort of starts to char and almost burn and get really crispy. That's how you eliminate that kind of slimy note that people tend to dislike about okra. But, you know, that recipe is perfect okra to me.
And you say actually frozen okra can work better than the fresh stuff?
Yeah. I mean, my parents were all about convenience growing up. You know, my mom didn't always have time to, you know, chop vegetables. So we relied a lot on frozen things and other convenience foods. And, you know, we actually found that frozen okra works beautifully.
We'll leave it there for now. Priya, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Priya Krishna. Her new cookbook is Indian-ish, Recipes and Antics from a Modern American Family. You could find a few of the recipes that she shared with us. We've got a dessert in there. We've got mutar paneer and a roti pizza. You can use rotis or whole wheat tortillas in a pinch. Find those all and lots of other Food Friday recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. It's time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an exploration of the Wisconsin cocktail. It's part of WPR's ongoing series exploring Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol.
When you think about a cocktail that embodies Wisconsin, what comes to mind?
Typically, you look for the old-fashioned.
The old-fashioned, because that's like the quintessential Wisconsin cocktail.
Ah, yes, the old-fashioned. And in Wisconsin, that typically means a brandy old-fashioned sweet or sour.
And that's the Wisconsin one where you add soda to it, which most people usually brandy with sometimes whiskey or bourbon.
That's John Dye, the owner of Bryant's, an historic cocktail lounge in Milwaukee. He says the original old-fashioned is a simple cocktail with bitters, sugar, and a spirit.
When somebody comes from out of town and they order an old-fashioned, that's generally what they want. If they order, somebody orders an old-fashioned without specifying sweet or sour, we have to ask them where they're from. And that's usually a way to get to the bottom of it.
Some say the recipe made its way to Wisconsin from New Orleans via the Mississippi River. But Wisconsinites really latched onto the cocktail after Korbel was introduced at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. Bryant's is known for another cocktail with Wisconsin roots. Its founder, Bryant Sharp, invented a few ice cream cocktails back in the 1930s for a liquor company.
I think the most famous one that people know is the Pink Squirrel. It's sort of a cream-based drink that has sort of an almond flavor to it, and it's a pink color.
Although you can find recipes for a Pink Squirrel in books and online, the folks at Bryant's will not divulge its secret recipe. Dye says it's a tradition that goes back to Sharp's time.
When he first started hiring people, he would actually wrap all the bottles in foil and everything was numbered, so not even the bartenders would know what they were pouring. So it's always been very secret. And we still keep a sort of secret nature of our recipes. We don't tell people our recipes and we kind of keep them to ourselves and have for 80 years. And a lot of the recipes we use are Bryant's original recipes, which is a pretty neat thing.
But what other cocktails embody Wisconsin?
Well, you start with your pint glass, then you fill it with ice, and it gets 2 shots of vodka. And then we use our Bloody Mary mix is Zing Zing, and you top it off with a pickle, couple olives, mushroom.
Don't forget the beer chaser.
Wash down the tomato juice, I think, is why they do that.
Jessica Carnop is a bartender at Kroll's West in Green Bay. Its neighbor across the street, Lambeau Field. Needless to say, she and her coworkers mix a lot of Bloody Marys on football Sundays.
And we actually pre-make those for the game days because we get so many of them. especially our noon games. We open up at 8 and people come in. Bloody Marys is one of our most popular drinks that they get.
But why are Bloody Marys so common for tailgating parties and for brunches across Wisconsin?
They taste so good.
All right, so we've talked about the Old Fashioned, Pink Squirrel, and Bloody Mary, all classic common cocktails found across Wisconsin. But what about something different, something modern?
So we're going to go with a cocktail we call Breakfast with Petey Pablo.
Thor Messer is the beverage director for restaurant group Rule Number One, which includes Merchant in Madison. He says Breakfast with Petey Pablo is a non-traditional scotch cocktail with chai tea, whipped cream, and most importantly, coffee.
Wisconsin has done an amazing job with coffee over the last 10 years. You know, we were looking at local producers and farmers and things like that, and we're like, well, coffee is like a legit thing that we're doing on a big scale that's really great.
And what about Petey Pablo? You know, the rapper from the early 2000s?
It just tied in perfectly because scotch is traditionally peaty. So peat is essentially the smokiness or that earthiness that you get out of scotch whiskey. And Petey Pablo, it just kind of morphed into this, like, well, that's fun.
This story was part of WPR's project High Tolerance. It's a deep dive into Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. There, you can also find recipes for each of the cocktails featured in this story.
I'm old-fashioned, because I want an old-fashioned with plenty of brandy and cherry on top.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Governor Tony Evers declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water. Statewide, residents are faced with a number of water pollution concerns, ranging from chemical and lead contamination to fertilizer runoff from some large farms. Earlier this week, we talked to a pair of Republican lawmakers about their plans to tackle the issue. Now we talk to a Democratic state lawmaker about initiatives she's worked on to address water quality issues. Representative Katrina Shanklin is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, which includes Stevens Point. Representative Shanklin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what do you see as the most pressing issues when it comes to water quality in Wisconsin?
So here in Wisconsin, we have many different issues. Just yesterday, we saw the governor and some legislators introduce legislation as it relates to PFAS, which is an emerging contaminant that's being found in chemicals like firefighting foam, for example. But we also have lead in our water where there's lead lateral lines. We've got nitrate contamination across central, northeast, and southwest Wisconsin among private wells, and especially in areas of the state that have either sandy soil or karst bedrock. We also have issues with arsenic. So there is no shortage of issues when it comes to water quality, and that's why I'm excited that there's so many clean water initiatives in the budget, which will be taken up on Tuesday, and why we have a water quality task force in the legislature right now.
Let's start with a nitrate issue. I know you've worked on legislation on this over the years, really. What kind of things do you see as top priorities when it comes to nitrates in those wells, in that swath, as you mentioned, diagonally across the state?
So I think we have multiple concerns and issues we need to tackle at the same time. Number one is education. Many people, about 1 in 5, have not tested their well within the past few years, even though the DNR recommends you should test your well every single year. So education is important. So my bill, AB 21, creates a new private well testing program that would allow the state to help local municipalities set up these well testing programs so homeowners can be educated about what's in their water. And local governments can really map out the hotspots of contamination and work to eradicate it through planning and remediation. So in addition to education, we also need to remediate. Many people have contaminated private wells in Wisconsin, and nitrate is one of the most common contaminants. When it comes to nitrate, if you're drinking water that's contaminated by nitrate that's above 10 milligrams per liter, you are at risk for your health, especially if you are a young child, a woman who's pregnant or wants to be, or an elder who might be vulnerable health-wise. So we need to help people afford the cost of reconstructing their well, remediating their well, hooking up to a public utility, treating the water, having a reverse osmosis system, for example. So what my bill does is the current well compensation grant program really is not accessible to most people. It currently requires for nitrate contamination that you have livestock, and most people I know with contaminated wells don't. So what it does is it removes that requirement. It increases the household income so that more people can qualify for this assistance, and it helps pay for any of those options, whether we're talking replacement, reconstruction, treatment, hooking up to utility, and that is also in the governor's budget. And in addition to that, what Governor Evers proposed, which I'm really excited about, is he put in a hardship exemption. So if you are low income and you can't afford to replace your well or dig a new one, what he would do is he'd have you pay a $250 deductible and the state would pick it up. In many cases, through no fault of their own, people have contaminated wells to the point where they can't even drink water from their taps. So when Governor Evers declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water and then acted by investing $70 million in his budget for clean water, I was thrilled that he recognized the plight of both urban and rural people across the state, whether it's lead laterals or people with nitrate contaminated drinking water. We have so much work to do.
We heard from a couple of Republican senators, Senators Teston and Coles. They have some legislation they're working on when it comes to nitrates. There's some overlap there, including saying you don't have to have livestock to get this help. Do you see areas where you can work together with colleagues across the aisle and in this case, in the other chamber?
Yeah, so I have asked my colleagues to co-sponsor this legislation, which some of them did last session. And this session, the co-chair of Joint Finance co-sponsored it. So I'm really hoping that it passes through the budget. Since it is much more holistic, this bill doesn't just cover nitrate. It also covers arsenic, bacteria like E. coli, which has a significant health risk. So, for example, if you were to go to Kewaunee County, not only is there nitrate contamination, but about one in three people with private wells cannot drink their water. And some of that is because of coliform bacteria. And so when you have the presence of E. coli in your drinking water, that's a serious health risk. So they would have access to this program, which is very different than that other bill that just focuses on nitrates and only covers $2,500, whereas the well compensation program covers up to 75% of your costs for arsenic, E. coli, coliform bacteria, and nitrates. So we're talking, you know, a new well can go up to $12,000, $14,000, $15,000, even $16,000, depending on the situation. So having 75% of that covered by the state, I think, is much more holistic and comprehensive than a $2,500 check. And that's why I'm really pushing to get this done in the budget where it is right now. And the Joint Finance Committee is taking up the DNR proposed budget on Tuesday. So I really would encourage them to act on this. But I'll also say this is not a solution when it comes to getting people and guaranteeing people clean drinking water, nor is a bill to just provide a few checks to people with nitrate contamination. What we need to do is work together to prevent this contamination from happening. So in addition to education and remediation, providing people clean water right away, what we really need to focus on and what I've been really honing in on in the task force is preventing contamination from happening. So with nitrate, for example, that's really a land use issue. That's a product of using organic or inorganic fertilizer. What can we do to work together to prevent the overuse of it in some cases? And how can we incentivize managing that use very carefully so we know exactly how much is going in and we can predict what the watersheds and groundwater will look like down the road. And that's why I think the task force on water quality needs to be having a bipartisan and bicameral conversation with all stakeholders, including agriculture, including our environmental groups, including our county conservationists and legislators from both parties, to work together and formulate a real solution that will prevent nitrate from getting into our groundwater in the first place, because it is incredibly costly to clean up. The Groundwater Coordinating Council has predicted about $456 million just to clean up nitrate contaminated wells. So we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Talking to Representative Katrina Shanklin, a Democrat from Stevens Point, looking at water quality issues in Wisconsin and in the state budget. And Representative Shanklin, the governor's budget had included money to help with lead lateral replacement to tackle the lead side of the equation here. That has been removed, I believe, by Joint Finance. What do you see as priorities for lead in drinking water?
So in addition to that $40 million in bonding authority to replace our lead service lines, we really need to commit to the people of our state that we'll be testing their water in schools and daycares more carefully to ensure that they do not have lead in their water. What we also need to do is take a look at how we can help our local municipalities. In the last session, we passed legislation to help them cover, to allow them to cover up to half the cost. But really, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars just to replace lead service lines. And so we need to look at a long-term solution. And I was happy with the governor's $40 million in money to replace lead service lines. I was disappointed that some of my colleagues said that they shouldn't be paying for lead service lines in Milwaukee, when I'll point out we're currently as taxpayers paying for people who are eligible to get new wells in rural parts of the state. We all have to work together on this, and we need to support each other, whether we're talking about PFAS, bacteria in our water, nitrate in our water, arsenic in our water, or lead in our water. And so what I'm doing is calling on the Joint Finance Committee to put that money back in. I'm sure Democrats on the committee will be doing the same thing. But in addition, what we really need to recognize is, regardless of where you live, everyone deserves access to clean water. Doesn't matter the contaminant, doesn't matter your zip code. It should be a basic right to have access to clean water. And in the year of clean drinking water, I think the governor proposed incredible solutions, because he didn't just put money in for lead or for nitrate. He put money in for everyone, including money for developing and prioritizing sites with PFAS contamination to identify that, using a model, doing groundwater studies in southwest Wisconsin, working on targeted runoff management, looking at urban non-point source and stormwater pollution, talking about pollution control measures for phosphorus. There's so many ways that he's investing. And I think that's the right way to go about it, is holistically, so we're not picking winners and losers, but we're saying here in the state of Wisconsin, everyone should be able to turn on their tap and drink their water from their tap, period.
As we wrap up, Representative Shanklin, do you see this as a kind of water moment, given that we've got stories affecting so many different parts of the state?
Yes, absolutely. For years, I have been talking about how here in Portage County, 1 in 4 people cannot drink water from their drinking wells. And unfortunately, most people in the legislature didn't seem to either believe it or prioritize it. Now that they're hearing from their constituents that in southwest Wisconsin, 42% of people can't drink from their wells, or in Kewaunee County, 33%, or in central Wisconsin, like in the towns of Armenia and a few other towns in the central stands, it's 42% as well, they realize that this is an issue that affects us all. So I hope that we can really form a bipartisan consensus to help people with lead laterals who need replacing, to help people with PFAS contamination from Marinette to Superior to Madison, to help people who have nitrate contaminated wells and bacteria contaminated wells. If we work together and prioritize this issue in the legislature, we will absolutely be doing what the people want us to do, because as we travel around the state as members of the task force, we're hearing the exact same thing from everyone. They want clean drinking water, and they want us to work together to prevent this from ever happening again. And that's something that I'm very committed to.
Representative Shanklin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Representative Katrina Shanklin is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 71st Assembly District, which includes Stevens Point. She joined us today to talk about water quality issues around the state, including chemical contamination affecting residents' drinking water and what can be done at the state level to fix the issue. We're wrapping up our 2-week-long look at alcohol in Wisconsin. Today we have the story of one of the first Black-owned breweries in the country. A group of African-American businessmen bought the Oshkosh-based People's Brewing Company in 1970. Now, the brewery's history and legacy is being remembered in an exhibit from the Milwaukee County Historical Society. Ben Barbera is the curator of the exhibit for the Historical Society. Ben, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, People's Brewing had a long prehistory before it was bought by this group of mostly Milwaukeeans in 1970. Can you give us a little of the backstory?
Sure. People's is a really interesting instance of a cooperative brewery that came together in the very early part of the 20th century. It was sort of a reaction to the brewing forces in Oshkosh at the time, having control over the local taverns and really having control over beer prices. And so a group of tavern owners got together and created this brewery that they aptly named People's Brewing Company. They first raised the money in 1911, and it started producing beer in 1913.
And I'll fast forward to the late 60s and this group led by Ted Mack in Milwaukee. Can you first tell us about him?
Yeah, Ted Mack was an interesting guy. He was raised in the South, went to Ohio State for a little while, and then transferred to Marquette and was living in Milwaukee. And he got a job working for Pabst in the 1960s. And one of his responsibilities with Pabst was sort of being a leader of integrating the workforce. He was also involved in civil rights, the civil rights movement, and various other activities. And so he was a very forward-thinking individual. And so he and a bunch of other people created this United Black Enterprises, known as UBE, to really further black entrepreneurial efforts in Milwaukee in the late 60s.
And how did they come to buy People's Brewing?
Well, the very first project that they embarked on was to try to buy Blatt's. Pabst had acquired Blatt's in 1958, but due to antitrust regulations, were not allowed to hold it, and they were going to have to sell it. And so the UBE entered into bidding for Blatt's, but the going price was roughly $10 million, which was a little bit outside of what they could reach, and it was eventually sold to Heilemann. So the UBE still was interested in this idea of a black-owned brewery, and so they turned their sights on Peoples, which at the time realized that they were having trouble continuing with their business model at the time and were looking to sell.
And this was a tough time for small to mid-sized breweries in the country, right?
Yeah, contraction had been going on for decades, and at this point there were roughly 100 breweries left in the country producing beer, at least sort of shipping breweries. And so these small breweries like Peoples and a lot of other ones in Wisconsin that were folding at the same time were really struggling against the big ones like Pabst and Schlitz and Anheuser-Busch.
And now at this time, there weren't African-American-owned breweries or a lot of African-owned businesses, period, of that size, right?
Right. Most African-American-owned businesses at the time were small, you know, service-oriented business, barbershops, restaurants, and things like that. And there weren't a lot of large African-American-owned businesses, certainly not in Milwaukee. And so an enterprise like this was really sort of bold and novel at the time.
We're talking to Ben Barbera, a curator at the Milwaukee County Historical Society, looking at the history of People's Brewing, owned by a group of African-American business people in Milwaukee, the brewery itself in Oshkosh. Ben, talk about the short life then of People's Brewing after it was purchased by this group, Ted Mack and his colleagues.
Yeah, so fortunately, Ted Mack was a charismatic guy because he immediately faced a lot of issues. There were rumors that UBE was only going to hire black employees. They were going to force out any white employees at People's. There were rumors that the beer, the quality of the beer was going to go downhill. And in fact, Ted Mack had to send a sample to the Siebel Institute in Chicago to get tested, and they came back with very good results. And initially in Oshkosh, there was a lot of backlash, and almost all of the taverns and stores pulled People's off of the shelves. But eventually, Ted Mack was able to convince them to return to selling the beer. And so in the first year, things looked pretty good for People's. They had raised a fair amount of money from the community. They were selling beer. They were the only non-Milwaukee beer that was sold at Milwaukee County Stadium and at the Milwaukee Bucks games. And so Ted Mack had some big expansion plans to move into predominantly African-American markets throughout the country and expand nationwide.
And that backlash you mentioned, was it in part or completely because this was a group of black people running the brewery?
Race was definitely a factor. Oshkosh had some civil unrest earlier, about a year before People's was officially bought, called Black Thursday, and so there was definitely a pushback that was race based. And Mack was well aware of this and did his best to smooth things over.
And Ted Mack, I understand, was concerned that, okay, all the black employees this company had were in Milwaukee. The staff at Oshkosh was all white. He was hoping to integrate the company.
Yeah, he really was. He didn't want to, while he wanted to promote black entrepreneurship and black business, he didn't necessarily want the company to have any sort of racial divide or even sort of a strong racial component. He wanted to sell beer. He wanted to have a successful company, and he wanted to promote black ownership of businesses. And so he he really worked hard to make everybody happy. And even though the brewery was only around for a short time, people who worked for him said he was a great person to work for.
Yeah, ultimately, no matter who owned it, People's Brewing faced the same problems that a brewery of its size faced in the country at the time.
Absolutely. They simply could not compete with the large brewers, both from the standpoint of these brewers could just swamp the market, and they also were controlling the prices, as it turned out. And so Mac and Peoples ran into a problem of being able to distribute the beer widely, and sales faltered too, because white people didn't want to necessarily drink a black beer, and it was a premium priced beer, and so people in some of the more depressed markets couldn't afford it. And so despite the big plans of Mac, sales were not matching up to what he was hoping to do.
Now here we are 4 decades or so after they closed down. Take us into your exhibit now. What do we see?
So this is our summer exhibit. It's a pop-up exhibit. And so we have some images, and we tell the story of Peoples. We also have some cool artifacts, some cans and bottles and other things like that from both Peoples before the ownership by UBE, but also during that period. And it's really, I've been wanting to tell this story for a few years now. And my collaborator, John Harry, who's a graduate student at UWM, came to me. He had done a lot of research on Peoples, and we talked about it, and we decided that this was a good time to have this exhibit pop up at the Historical Society.
Looking back from this vantage point where we have all these local and regional breweries in Wisconsin, does it seem like a kind of a could have been story? If something like this had happened now, it might have a shot?
Yeah, absolutely. Had they, been doing this 10 years, 20 years later, they might have had a good chance. And it's interesting to see, black ownership is still very underrepresented in brewing today, but they are starting to emerge. Lots of black-owned breweries are popping up all over the country. And so, in a different climate, in a different environment, Peoples under the ownership of Ted Mack and his team might very well have taken off.
Now, I imagine that a story like this might point off with threads in other directions. Are there follow-ups you might be interested in doing down the road?
Well, this stemmed from our current exhibit on our current feature exhibit on Prohibition and how after Prohibition the brewing industry changed. But we've done other looks at beer and brewing, and one of the things we've really kind of focused on is how brewing used to be very much a regional or neighborhood establishment. Then it became big corporations, and then it became small and regional again. And so it's really interesting looking at how things have sort of returned to the origins with brewing. And there's lots of opportunities to tell that story in a lot of different ways.
And briefly, Ted Mack, in our last 30 seconds or so, what did he go on to after Peoples?
He returned to Milwaukee, where he did social work and sold insurance for a while. And then ultimately, he ended up in Atlanta. And he actually just passed away recently at the age of 88.
Ben, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Ben Barbera, curator at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. He's with us today to talk about an exhibit and the story of Peoples Brewing Company. It's one of the first black-owned breweries in the country, Milwaukee-based business people. The brewery bought in Oshkosh. You can see all of our stories in our series High Tolerance, looking at the complicated relationship with alcohol here in Wisconsin. There have been 2 weeks' worth of stories, a lot you've heard, a lot of visuals you can find online, too. Head over to WPR.org/alcohol. That's WPR.org/alcohol. And if you have thoughts on what we've talked about, send us a note. Ideas@WPR.org is the best email address to send it to. NASA is offering an opportunity for you to make the journey to Mars. Well, not all of you, just your name. This week, NASA invited members of the public to submit their names to be sent to Mars with a new Mars rover, possibly as soon as summer of next year. You can get your name on the list from now until September 30th. Find that info at nasa.gov. Here's the thing. It might not be so easy to read the names on the list. Not that anyone's going to be there to read it. The names will be engraved at NASA's Micro Devices Laboratory. Now, that name should give you a clue. They're going to use an electron beam to stencil the list of names onto a silicon chip. The lines of text will be 75 nanometers. That's smaller than 1,000th the width of a human hair. That's according to the NASA press release. That's going to let them fit more than a million names on a chip the size of a dime. And by the way, you can get some frequent flyer miles from NASA. You don't actually get to fly anywhere with them. More than 2 million names flew along with a previous Mars mission, collecting over 300 million frequent flyer miles each. You're going to do it? I don't think I'll actually make it to Mars myself. The idea sounds cool, but you know, I get motion sickness in the back of a car. So the space trip might not be the thing for me. Sending my name might be just the ticket. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.